My name is Vern Reike, for those of you that I have not had a chance to meet yet. I teach at the University of Washington School of Law. I am, I guess, the lawyer that Dave Rhodes was talking about in his very fine lesson on the story of Mark, or Mark's story this morning. I thought that he posed a very nice problem for us in the introductory portion of the Gospel of Mark. Mark's ability to see Christ as being able to cure the withered hand and the blind and even to restore life from death is not the situation that we find ourselves in. I'm not able to bring off that kind of cure or solution to problems. And yet I, as you, frequently find myself in a position where I've got to decide an issue. And not infrequently those issues are cast in such a way that either decision that I make is going to be harmful to someone. Sometimes these things are called tragic choices. And I wonder, we'll be talking about what you think God's will is with reference to us when we have to decide that kind of a problem. Maybe Dave will tell us in successive sections of the Gospel of Mark. In the meantime, I intend this session, the first of a series of four, to deal with these problems in the context of parents and children. I choose parents and children for two reasons. One is it's a subject that I teach, therefore, presumably, I know a little bit about it. Secondly, because it poses probably more sharply than anywhere else the question of whether or not we own our children. Are they ours? Do we get to make the decisions about their lives? Is decision making for children, our children, the kind of exercise of power that leads ultimately to uneasiness between parent and child, maybe even animosity? In my own opinion, good parenting means that you start out with this wet and noisy bundle, totally unable to make decisions for herself or himself, and guide that incompetent to a few years later when you reach maturity and hope that that child of yours is able to stand independently, to make its own judgments. And that's not something that happens immediately. It happens over a period of time. Parenting means the ability to let go and to encourage decision making by the child, even when sometimes the child's decision is to tell Dad to buzz off. Tonight I want to open that discussion by asking the question about what are the limitations that we ought to impose on ourselves, or that are necessarily imposed on us in terms of making decisions for the child. The next session I hope to talk about what we commonly call custody, after the parents have decided not to live together. And in that connection, I would like for you, before you leave tonight, if you're interested in that discussion, to pick up a copy of a letter which will provide the background for that discussion. It's a letter written by a man, a parent of a child who has remarried and who is having all of the custody and child support problems that one so frequently encounters. He sets the stage so beautifully in his letter that I think it's a good place for us to start that discussion. Third session, we'll talk about support, who gets supported and for how long, circumstances. And the last session, we'll talk about enforcement of parental rights and parental obligations. Tonight, in order to get to our problem as quickly as possible, I would like to start with what is probably the easiest kind of problem that we have to decide in this area. I will pose briefly facts for you, and then you can resolve that problem for me and tell me why your decision is right, and then we'll pass on to the next problem and so forth. This problem was one which involved a 5-year-old boy whose parents decided to go out for the evening, and they employed a babysitter. The babysitter, during the course of the night, became infuriated with the boy's conduct. And among other things, he picked up the boy and swung the boy by his feet and hit his head against the wall. The resulting injury was of such a nature that the medical advice is that the boy will never be able to recover. The life of the infant is, in fact, if it is life, is being preserved by mechanical means. Breath or air is being forced in and comes out, and circulation is maintained. There is, over a period of some weeks, no indication of any activity in the brain. The question is, shall this mechanism, this mechanical preservation of simulated breathing and simulated circulation, if that's a fair way of describing it, be continued, or shall it be terminated? And this case arose in a simple context, because the question was, is the child dead or is the child alive? You may interrogate me if you like. Those are the facts. I want you to decide, is this 5-year-old boy maintained by this mechanism with no indication of brain activity despite repeated stimulation, hot, cold, and pain, and jabbing with needles and so forth, no brain activity of any sort, dead or alive?
What state is this?
State of Washington.
How long has he been this way?
About 3 weeks.
What was the nature of the brain injury? Was there a hematoma?
I'm sorry, I don't know. I can't tell you. The court decision just didn't give me that detail.
Do you have any doctor's opinions on them?
Yes, the doctors have given us the tests, the result of the tests that they have done, and their decision is that there is no activity in the brain or the brain stem of any sort. Perfectly flat, yes.
In similar instances, then this child would be candidate for organ transplant donations?
Might very well be, if we decide that he's not going to use those organs anymore. You've been reading the title of tonight's lecture, haven't you?
Oh,
no. You see, that is the problem.
Yeah.
When is this life ended? And if there are valuable organs that can be used somewhere else, when
it just sounded as if, you know, the description fit what in other cases I've read, that they have decided to remove the kidney and so forth.
Somebody, the hospital, wanted to know whether or not they could discontinue maintaining this care.
Did you find that there was disagreement from some of the parties about
it? None. This is an early enough case so that no one had ever talked about brain death. And those people who are providing care, having undertaken the care once, are at risk if they discontinue and let life perish because of their discontinuance. So they want to know, is this child dead and can we turn off the machinery, or is the child still alive? Well, this is the simplest case that we have, and we don't dare spend more time with it. We've got to get on to some complex problems here. So we will poll the court and see. How many of you say that it is at this point permissible to discontinue treatment? Please raise your hand. Well, we've got practically a solid bench on that one, all right. And that's what happened. And it is our first, and as I say, probably our least bothersome problem. Second case is a bit more complex. A 66-year-old woman, cancerous larynx. Question is whether to radiate, a permissible form of treatment, or to provide surgery, surgical removal. The latter, of course, would result in no voice, but is, in terms of preserving life, perhaps the better way to go, perhaps. It's what the medical people involved thought. A complication arose because this woman not only had this illness, but she was also so severely retarded that she could not understand the nature of her illness or the proposed treatment. She did have some understanding. For example, she knew that if she were cut, it hurt, and she did not want to be hurt. And so when she was asked, after giving her the best explanation that could be given, she said she did not want to be hurt. She didn't want surgery. Because she was essentially mentally incompetent, her son was appointed as her guardian, and her son took the position that we want mother with us, we want to preserve her life. The advice that we are given is that while either treatment is a possibility, that the odds are much better if surgery is used rather than radiation, and therefore we want radiation. We want surgery. There was a great deal of nervousness on the part of the people who were asked to provide treatment of one kind or the other. They did not know whether the mother's wishes should be followed, despite her incompetency, or whether the son, as guardian, had the possibility of making that decision. So everybody moved to a judge and asked the question. I'm open for argument and then decision.
Was the son the legal guardian?
Son was appointed as guardian for his mother.
Had he been the guardian before?
Had not been.
Had they determined that she was incompetent? Was that a judicial determination, or did the doctor?
The judicial determination was that she was able to understand something of this problem, but not enough to really be understanding of the nature of the illness or of the proposed remedies. And the question was whether or not in that circumstances a person of limited, sharply limited competence, but not truly incompetent. She never had a guardian before. She was able to maintain herself in her own apartment. This was a more complex problem than she had faced before.
Have there been any treatment up to that point?
Previous treatment? From the point of diagnosis on, none yet, at least none that we're told about.
She hadn't had any kind of radiation?
Had not yet. The treatment had not yet begun.
Would it be true to say that no matter which choice was made, the woman would suffer pain, would be hurt, regardless of whether it was radiation or whether it was...
I'm sure that either treatment would be difficult.
Other family members that had an opinion?
No other family members involved in this one.
Was it recently that she became incompetent, or had she been like this before?
She'd been this way for a number of years, but never incompetent enough so that she needed care other than what her family gave her, her son gave her informally, and friends and so forth.
Had the cancer metastasized?
I can't answer that. I don't know. However, without treatment, apparently death would have, I assume, was imminent. At least the question was what kind of treatment to give. And I think life-threatening is a fair assumption.
Was she labeled as gravely disabled under...
She was not labeled.
What's the legal definition of
guardian? Was a problem that was involved in the case. The court said that we're going to appoint the son as guardian in order to have him receive the information and to make a decision. The son came back and said, I have heard the information, I've got the facts, I've now made my decision. My decision is surgery. The people who were asked to provide the treatment, the hospital and the MDs involved, said, can a guardian do that? The son said, sure, that's what they appointed me for. Attorney's advice was not so clear that guardians have that power, because guardians are not permitted to make a decision which disfigures, amputates, or causes death. And we would like to get some more information about this So that's the state of the case when they go to the court and ask, what do we do now? The issue posed for the court was, can the son as guardian make this decision? If you were court, what decision would you reach?
I think it'd be more compassionate of the son to not allow his mother to be disfigured, because she would definitely be aware of that, even if her intelligence was limited.
Well, she's going to be more limited if they do the surgery and she can't talk, so she's going to become more retarded. And she's been able to make all the decisions on her own without a guardian up until this point, and all of a sudden they're taking
that right away from her
when she is already within her own realm of competence, made the decision herself.
So your conclusion?
That they had no, the son has no right to be the one to make the decision.
And the court so held. It said that the court could not decide. Now what do you do? The son could not decide. Now what do you do? Radiation.
First. Yeah, try it first.
And that's what was decided in this case. Next case. This time we have...
Did they feel that she had given informed consent?
Presumably the best of her competence. I think one feels some uneasiness at this point of, would you treat that person? Well, at all? There are risks involved, obviously, and it seems to me the conclusion reached by you people is not very helpful in the circumstances. It doesn't permit really anything to be done with any kind of confidence, but that's where we came down on that one. Next case involves a 69-year-old woman. She had a heart attack. She was without oxygen for 10 minutes. She is now in what was described as a chronic vegetative state. She is not brain dead, but on the other hand, the best prognosis is that she has no real prospect ever of recovering either mind, mental competence, or the ability to move, to be active in any sense. This woman, 69 years old, lived at a time when she could have had a so-called living will or a natural death act provision. That is to say, she could have written a document which might have said, in the event of this kind of a situation, I do not wish to be treated, I wish to be permitted to die. She did not have such a document. I point this out because now we have a woman who had been competent. In the prior case, the woman had arguably never been competent. Now we have a woman who had been competent before she had this heart attack, but she had not exercised her power at the time when she could have done that herself. After a lot of struggle, her husband was appointed guardian. And that was not an easy thing to do. In the event that she died, her husband would inherit her estate. And you immediately get the basis of some conflict. But when the court considered all of its options, it said the person who knows this woman best of anyone on earth is the man with whom she has lived for over 40 years. A good, solid marital relationship. He knew and loved her. And the court said, we believe that his concern for her overbalances the risk that he would act selfishly, and appointed him guardian. One of the questions put to him was, did you and your wife ever discuss what should be done in the event that you should become gravely disabled, something like this? And he said, my wife and I talked about that many times. And she told me, as I told her, should that circumstance ever arise, let me die. I do not wish to live, if that's life, under those circumstances. So now we have a guardian appointed by the court to gather information, who has gathered the basic factual information, and who further testifies that he knows what his wife wanted done and what she would have asked to be done had she lived, had she remained competent. And so the husband says, permit her to die. Following in the track of the former case, which said that a guardian does not have the power to make that determination, there was, understandably, a great deal of uneasiness on the part of the medical people to permit her to die. And they went to the trial court and said, what shall we do? Does this guardian get to make that decision, or does he not get to make the decision?
Other family members?
No other family members. Lots of friends who could testify, and did at the appointment of the guardian, to the fact that this had been a strong, solid marital relationship, concern for the wife.
Are we kind of in a brain death situation here, too?
No brain death. She is not dead.
Yeah.
Not by the measure of brain death. That is to say, if jabbed with a needle, you still get reaction, cold, light, heat, and so forth. Yes, sir?
Is she dependent upon the mechanical means?
Yes.
Completely?
Yes.
How long has she been that way?
I can't answer. Long enough so that it's clear that that's the way it's going to be.
Well, in essence, if you are to believe her guardian, and I think 40 years of living together would indicate that they had something going as far as, you know, a good relationship anyway, and knowing each other well, that she, in essence, made the decision, not him. He's relating her decision rather than trying to intuit from the relationship what her decision would have been.
How do you like that, ladies and gentlemen? That what we're really doing is asking her to make her decision through a surrogate who knows what she wanted. You buy that? So what we're respecting here, if you decide to go that direction, is since it is lawful for a competent person to decide, I do not want this kind of continuation after I have become hopelessly chronic vegetative state. And since she missed that, now we're going to give her a next shot. Now, of course, the Natural Death Act says that the person must be competent, that the person must be fully informed, that there must be witnesses, that there must be formality. I mean, we don't want relatives putting away senile parents or other persons for the convenience of those who are alive now. In other words, there's real danger here that I'm sure you all sense in allowing this husband, good guy though he may be, to make these kind of statements. May be true in this case. The next case, maybe not so true. And we've all heard stories of people who act quite selfishly in putting people into mental institutions, and now here comes a wonderful opportunity to do even better. Simply have them die. Yes, sir.
It seems like the problem that we've gotten ourselves into from the last case, this case, is now we have guardians. We said it wasn't okay for guardians to decide. Now we have a guardian deciding. And
we have a guardian being asked what the wish of the incompetent was.
Okay, but then the problem becomes for doctors and things is that almost every one of these cases has to go to court. Because really, as it stands right now, the court's got to make the decision about whether the guardian is competent in his decision making and what the guardian comes up with. And so are we able to establish a court or a group of people who are going to make these decisions? How would we feel about that?
You notice the court's been deciding so far. One time in the cases that we've had, the court simply punted by saying, no, the guardian can't do that, and went back, and we don't know what was to be done. But of course, that's the function of a court, to decide that which doesn't have an answer. And that is the function of a court, to decide that which cannot be proven scientifically or in any other way. It's to make a value judgment That's why lawyers always talk about judgments, opinions, decisions. You never hear lawyers talking if they're being careful about knowable, scientifically demonstrable proof. Nobody's going to pay me my fee and go to court to get an answer to something that's knowable by wrapping litmus paper around it. So in a sense, yeah, that's the function. But of course, it's terribly inconvenient, and you're right, it's slow, and it's expensive, and it's painful, and it's traumatic.
And it doesn't often happen.
And it doesn't often happen. Maybe we can develop a rule here.
Most of the time it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen.
And it replaces a bunch of strangers. I mean, they have replaced the decision. Really, they are deciding. A bunch of strangers decided instead of the relevant.
I think I hear sort of some votes here for letting the husband go ahead.
I disagree with that.
Disagree with that, okay.
Well, it seems to me like these two things, the first case and this one, are different because the first one is who's going to decide what kind of treatment to give. Is it going to be surgery or is it going to be radiation? But this one, who's going to decide if this person should live? Are we going to let... I don't think that another human being should have the power to say, yeah, this person should die. Not even that person themselves. I think that is God's prerogative.
Of course, no one's going to kill this woman, now you understand.
But on the other hand, a very few years ago, there would be no way to sustain that life.
That woman would have been dead. It's by intervention of man that we're sustaining people now. Seattle's got a great record for kind of one for bringing people back from the dead.
In one sense, I suppose, the first time somebody cooked up some leaves and gave somebody some medicine, we intervened in one sense in the process. And the question now, have we gone too far in the intervention? And shall we say, thus far and no further? I say, should we decide? Somebody has to decide. It's in process. The woman is being maintained. I mean, it's happening right now. And the question is, will someone decide, can someone decide whether or not to turn it off, or do we simply accumulate more and more and hospitals full and, and I'll paint a horribly gloomy picture now, but I'm sure you all see the projection of what we're talking about. Yes, ma'am.
I think that when you get to a point where a person is on artificial means of keeping them alive, and the person has previously expressed a wish not to live, then if you insist that person be kept alive by artificial means, are you prolonging death or are you prolonging life?
May I fuss just a little bit about the word artificial?
Well, mechanical.
Mechanical?
Extraordinary measures.
Extraordinary measures. It's not like eating and drinking, that's what you're saying?
Yeah.
You know, got
where do you put aspirin tablets in that?
2 feet.
Well, no,
or is that just part of the decision?
No, I think that if it's a measure that if it were withdrawn, the person would die. I mean, if you withhold an aspirin.
I suppose if we went around this room right now, we could scare out a few folks who, if they don't take their medication every once in a while, are not going to live very long. I don't know about you, but I've carried tablets around once in a while. And is that artificial means where you know, that every morning you've got
to
take...
But that's not artificial means, hopefully, to sustain a normal productive
life.
You're
not using artificial means to keep somebody alive.
So normal life ought to be sustained, and depreciated life ought to be terminated. Or
non-life
permitted.
Should be depreciated. I think non-life should be terminated. I think a person who has no hope of being in communication, I've had people tell me this, and I would honor that. If they can no longer communicate and act and perform as a human being, they don't want to be there.
Like a newborn?
Unfortunately, I happen to believe one should not go to great extraordinary measures for multiply handicapped newborns.
You threw in a ringer on me there. You've got multiply handicapped. I was just thinking of someone who is incompetent of sitting up and talking and taking care of daily activities, which is, of course, the way all children are born. Like when I want to key somebody, I tell them Washington is a great place to live. When I first came here, I didn't have a hair in my head nor a tooth in my mouth. I couldn't feed myself, eat nothing but milk. And look at me now, you know, well, of course, I was born here. And that's not what you mean, and I know that's not what you mean, but But before we get through tonight, I want to push this conversation to the point of saying, do parents have the power to make decisions about children? Well, until rather recently, parents did have that power. In fact, in the Roman law, parents could with impunity kill their children. Indeed, the husband, paterfamilias, a big person in those days, could kill wife, children, slaves, cattle, the whole thing. Our law has slowly evolved, even in the United States, as new a nation as we are. A father had the right to beat and, if necessary, kill a child who was disobedient. Now, why not? Father owned the child. It was his child. Now, this will become tougher tomorrow night or tomorrow sometime if you're still around and we talk about custody. But right now I'm just trying to establish some perimeters of what it means to be a parent of a child. And I'm sneaking up on that issue by asking whether or not one human being should ever, your question is the vital one, ever make a decision which will result in the death of another person. Of course, I can say, as I did before, that no one is going to kill this person. We're simply not going to provide mechanical support which will continue life. But if we do that on the quality of life and make that kind of a decision, how do we justify that? Is it that other people's lives will be better? That this family, which may be strapped already to try and support other children, will not have to spend money on an essentially, watch me now, worthless activity? Or do you feel the other way around, that a life is so valuable that no matter what happens to those living, you know, let the children go without food and clothing? No, I can paint horrible pictures here if you like.
I don't think the family's paying. It's been going on. It's been going on a month. The family's probably not paying for it anyway. Society's paying for it.
Probably it's the taxpayer that's doing it. Do we wish to spend our money that way? Or isn't it fair to say that society can avoid a tax burden by letting people die who could be maintained? Do you want a society which says that, well, we've taken your IQ and you're pretty low, off to Auschwitz you go? I mean, we watched Germany do that in the Second World War, and I break out in a rash about that one.
Do you think there's ever going to be a point where things like wills are going to be required by people, such as a law established or something, where people are going to be required to have a set up a will, and also at the same time making the decision about, you know, some point in your life,
I love that image of your free will here. Sit down and write it and tell us when you want to die. Which is a little rough. Well, you're a fascinating court, a lovely discussion. What are you going to do about this husband? Are you going to let him decide to do what his wife wanted to do or not?
Wasn't
there a similar case?
Keep her alive, but cut all the social service money.
That's a possibility.
Wasn't there a case, I think, the Quinlan girl?
Was the Quinlan girl. She was old enough to have made and who have expressed an opinion about this, and we are told she did, in family discussions, inform her father that should such a thing ever happen to her, she would not wish to be maintained.
So they eventually withdrew the support and she lived for a period of time?
Yes, indeed. And she died only rather recently after having lived for a long time, so predictions are not always
except that initial support. I mean, the ventilator was turned off, but they still support her to nasogastric feeding tube. And
indeed.
Many people say that's extraordinary.
Indeed. And you are, of course, foreseeing where we've got to go tonight. That is the withholding food and water from the infant who was born with massive disabilities.
Up here. That Quinlan case, I heard the mother speaking on a radio show, which really gave me an insight into something that I had realized, was that during the process of withdrawing the life support, the family wanted to take that support away.
But it took so many months for all the family to come to terms with the fact that their daughter was never coming back. I think the father was the last one to finally concede that his daughter was not coming back. But they let the family work through that grief process. Then by that time, she was 21, and the court wouldn't allow her, wouldn't allow the family the choice. And then they had to go back to court, and they got the life support systems to be removed. But they bled them off. They didn't just yank them. And that became a real point to me, that they knew that if they just pulled them out, she wouldn't be sustained. She would die. But they took her off for an hour one day, and then a couple days later for 3 hours, so that she would begin to breathe on her own, which is a very compassionate thing. And then she did live for
a long time.
Yeah. And so...
Wrong decision, should have jerked them off.
Pardon me?
Wrong decision, should have turned it off abruptly.
No, I think it was the right decision to do what the family wanted to do, and at least allow her the chance to live on her own. They weren't saying, like, terminate for life. We just want to terminate this equipment. And it, because it was making her very uncomfortable, she fought it and all this stuff.
You're all good lawyers. Your use of analogy is dandy. What do you do in the Collier case? That's the one with the husband out here that says, I know what my wife wanted.
Isn't the truth of the matter, though, that every day decisions like this are being made? We get these dramatic instances that hit the press, some that go to court, but by and large, families, physicians, clergymen, making decisions like this all the time, aren't they?
Yes and no, but it's a balance all the time. And the last doctor I was talking to was saying, even the living will doesn't answer. Because you have that living will, and you come up to it, and the doctor says, and I'm just say, this patient says unplug. But the doctor, he's looking at the patient's family saying,
who's going to sue
you? Right on.
That raises lots the of question out I have. Court. What liability does the doctor have if he doesn't follow that will, and can the family sue him? For imposing artificial means that have been distinctly requested not to be imposed.
Your use of analogy and spin-off problems is beautiful. I'm impressed. What do you do about the Collier case? I have told some of you before, I'll tell the rest of you now, since you are newly associated with the court, if you only have a limited number of days as a judge in this state and in most states after the case has been put to you to decide, if you do not decide within that time, your salary is stopped. And to my own personal knowledge, I have been the executive secretary for the Washington Judicial Council for 20 years, I guess. To my knowledge, I know judges that have gone without salary for 3 or 4 months. Simply thrown by the kinds of problems that we will get to when we get to the tough ones here, and unable to make a decision. And fact is, I know one guy who went into early retirement. He was almost there, and he didn't want to decide. Well,
don't people sometimes wake up?
I'm sorry.
Don't people sometimes wake up from the mistakes?
Oh, I suppose that in medical annals there are cases where they've made a wrong diagnosis and you come back or some miracle occurs. I think we must take a vote of the court and see what we shall do. The issue is, shall the husband, on the testimony that he is given of his wife's wishes, be permitted to make the decision, and will a court hearing that decision then say to the hospital and to the medical people, that decision has been lawfully made and you are made immune from any further liability if you remove the means of support. How many of you believe the husband should be permitted to make this decision? Are there dissenters?
The only, I wanted to make a comment on that.
This is a dissent with opinion.
Yes, ma'am. She's
the hard thing, if the doctor was, if the hospital was opposed to that kind of treatment, then it would have to be into a doctor's hands who was comfortable with carrying out the husband's wishes.
That's right.
That doctor couldn't be made to violate, I think Rich brought it up over there, to violate his conscience in how he believed personally.
That's correct.
So, yeah.
That's correct. We won't order that kind of activity by a professional. And it probably won't be necessary here, since this is a rather simple process, really. Would you care to say a word or two about the alleged criteria used in the Collier case? That is, we will permit the guardian to do not what the guardian thinks is best to do, not what the guardian believes that a reasonable, competent person should wish to do, or what most of us would wish to do, but what this person wished to do. Is that all right with you?
Yes.
No, it makes me real uncomfortable.
Real uncomfortable. A few yeses?
No.
Well, I think establishing that would be important. You know, if you have some corroboration rather than just an anecdote. Yeah, once in a while.
We can bring in a couple dozen close family friends who maybe heard the conversation, something like that. Of course, that's going to work for the first case. It won't be there for very many cases. The court said this is a surrogate decision for the incompetent. This is, as it were, the incompetent speaking, since the legislature, in its wisdom, has told us that the ill person may make that decision. Now, of course, they don't talk very much here about the fact that the legislature also said, with these kinds of guarantees of authenticity, written, signed, witnessed, and so forth. It's an extension of that.
That's next, a cop-out, it seems to me.
A cop-out.
Yeah. Okay. Easy way out.
How would you do it?
Well, I don't think there is an easy way out. There is no right answer to this. But to say that means that you then have to, in similar situations, have to be able to believe the husband is really staying.
Yes.
And I see that as being a major flaw in all of this.
Plus,
it says that the state doesn't have to make a decision, or the court doesn't have to make a decision then about, you know, anything related to whether she should or should not be dead.
Yeah. Not quite that easy, actually. There were four steps. I'm sure you all understand that every one of these cases I'm talking about got long, lengthy opinions with all kinds of rationale. Here there are four steps. First of all, you get the medical people who are involved to report what the medical facts are. Next, you appoint a guardian with a rather thorough screening and scrutiny to see whether that guardian can be trusted to act on behalf of the incompetent person. Thirdly, you get the report from the guardian as to the understanding of the facts, the reason for the decision, and if there is any argument about any of the facts, then you go to a court and ask the judge. Now, that may not be great consolation to you, because if you go back to the judge, now you're getting a person who, aside from the fact that you elected him to that particular position, probably knows less about it than anybody else that's involved. Henry Hamlin, 42-year-old, born blind and severely retarded. This 42-year-old had never in his life had enough mental competence to be able to execute a Natural Death Act instrument. In other words, could not make a living will, couldn't make a will of any sort, simply not enough mental competence. He was injured in an accident. He is not brain dead. He is in a chronic vegetative state. He's being maintained in the way that these other people have been. Has no family, no parent, no family, no anybody. The hospital says, we don't know what to do. The court says, well, I'll appoint a guardian. The court appointed a guardian. The guardian obviously has not the faintest clue what this man would have wanted. Never had competence in his life. I'm sneaking up on children, if you follow me. Born incompetent. They got some potential. This person didn't have the potential, he didn't have any competence. The guardian came back and the guardian said, I cannot make the decision. The hospital says, well, somebody's got to make the decision. So they went down to the court and said to the court, ask the guardian to make the decision. Is that the proper way to go?
No, they should have had a hospital ethics committee make the decision.
They did have a hospital ethics committee involved that gave us all of the medical facts. And the hospital people said, do you want our opinion as to whether it ought to terminate or not? We'll give you our opinion, but of course we are not going to make that decision without some order someplace that says that we will be protected from liability in our decision. Should we appoint the hospital staff as the guardian? The guardian appointed in this case, incidentally, was the foundation for the handicapped, an organization that works with handicapped people at all times.
If he has no relatives, who's going to sue?
The question is, shall we continue to have this room in the hospital and this machinery tied up?
Well, it's a societal question, too. When there are children that do have potential in this country, that do not have adequate housing, do not have adequate food, and their parents who do not have adequate employment, shall society continue to spend thousands of dollars every day tying up their equipment for this kind of problem?
Well, we're getting to cases now, aren't we? We'll leave this case for just a moment while we see where we may be going. That's fair. The girls now are about 13 or 14 years old. And the folks said to the one daughter with good kidneys, will you donate one of your good kidneys to your sister? And the one with the good kidney said, no, I will not. And the parent said, maybe you didn't understand the situation. Your sister will die, or at least be in horrible problems, you know, being sustained artificially with dialysis and so forth. Daughter, we want you to donate a kidney to your sister. No, I will not. I'm in control of my own life. You're not in control of your own life. You are a 13-year-old child, and we, your parents, will make your decisions. You march down to that hospital and lie down while they take out one of your kidneys. That's where we're going, folks. If parents have the ability to make decisions for people who are competent to make decisions. Now, I haven't gotten you there yet in the Hamlin case, but when we introduce the third person, your comment follows so logically. It's a social problem. It's for the good of society. It's for the good of others. And so why shouldn't we be able to say, look, you look like you've got pretty good kidneys. You're probably not going to use them an awful lot of years yet. And I know a 15-year-old over here really needs some. Or a heart, or, you know, practically anything that you've got that's working fairly well. Now that I've passed the age of I'm a senior citizen, I get a little nervous about that. I don't want to wind up a spare parts bank before my time has come. My parents are not around to make that decision anymore. So back I go to parents who are, what shall I call them? God's agents to care for children and to make decisions for children who are not yet able to make their own decisions. You may be bothered by the fact that the case I gave you, which is of course an actual case, involved 13-year-old twins. What if we run it down to the age of 4 or 3 or someplace where the decision cannot be made, where you wouldn't expect the child to understand that at that age?
That is an important distinction though, isn't it? A 13-year-old is a minor, but a knowledgeable minor.
Yes. It's what the law insists on calling a mature minor, if you like that one. And decisions are made on precisely that basis. Does that mean then at age 2 or 3 or 1 that the parents get to make the decisions?
Yes. Not at 13.
Not at 15. You see what you're doing, and I love it. Is to say that there is something about parenthood here that says you get to make decisions, but as the child develops the competency to understand the problem and address it, your responsibility as parent is to begin to discuss this with the child. Indeed, a parent is an agent who develops independence and creates liberty. We're modeling here after the act of salvation. God's Son has made me free. Even the Constitution of the United States says you are guaranteed liberty, privacy, power to make your own decision. To take away from a person who is competent the power to make a decision about anything is a terribly significant act, deprivation of liberty. However, the Constitution says that these rights are unalienable, to use the word of the Declaration of Independence. That does not mean they cannot be taken away. That means that you cannot give them away. To alienate means to give away, to transfer. I cannot transfer to somebody else my life, my liberty, and still remain a human being. Don't know whether you've ever reflected on the term human rights used in the Declaration of Independence. Human rights mean that one may not give away these things, or if they are taken away, that person stops being what God created, a human being. Now, little children and incompetents and other folks may not have the ability to keep themselves from being violated by society. But you ought to at least be able to trust your parents, shouldn't you?
Vern, aren't we seeing a ricochet on this too, with kids coming back after the age of 21 and suing your parents?
We are seeing that.
Decisions that were made that they disagreed with.
We are seeing that. Yes, we are. And the question then comes again, are parents legally entitled to be make those decisions and be protected? But that's not my real problem for you, ladies and gentlemen. Now we got to go to chapel, and we've introduced the real problem, which I hope to pursue more when we get to this question called custody. When parents claim the right of parenthood, both the responsibility for making decisions and allegedly the right to make those decisions, must those decisions be based solely, wholly, entirely on the welfare of this child? In the absoluteness of God's love, discussed so very well this morning by David Rose, followed by the power to heal the withered hand, and to restore the sight, unlimited power, unlimited love. But you don't have that power as a parent. You've got one child who is depriving you of your capacity to provide for your other three children because of the special needs of this child. Or if this child is preserved in this state, you are being deprived of your competence to parent effectively as well as you could to your other three children. Therefore, do you as parents have to split the cloth? Or is it the parent's obligation to remain loyal always to the needs of the child who is incapable of speaking for itself?